Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 14th of July. Our guest this hour came to our attention in a Bob Herbert column in the New York Times on July 5. The column was about the undercurrent of anxiety in the country this recent 4th of July. And Bob mentions David Boren's book, saying the anxiety seems more intense than the usual concern for a cyclical economic downturn. Something fundamental seems to have gone haywire. David Boren is a former U.S. senator who is now president of the University of Oklahoma and has written a short book that he calls A Letter to America. His sense of alarm in the opening paragraph could not have been clearer. The country we love is in trouble. In truth, we are in grave danger of declining as a nation. If we do not act quickly, that decline will become dramatic. Senator Boren served as governor of Oklahoma from 75 to 79 in the United States Senate from 79 to 94. He then became president of the University of Oklahoma, where he has served for the past 13 years. And he says for over 30 years as a state legislator, governor, U.S. senator, and now university president, he's been given a chance to closely observe and sometimes be involved in decisions that have influenced what has happened to our country. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050, or care to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Senator David Boren, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I was interested in what got this whole thing rolling. Tell us about serving on the Rhodes Scholarship Selection Committee and asking candidates, how long do you think the U.S. will be the world's leading superpower? And here were these brilliant people who obviously hadn't thought about that very much.
Well, that's absolutely right. It's what caused me to really sit down and write this little book. It really is just a letter. It's about a 100-page letter to the American people. And for many years, I'd been sitting on the Rhodes Scholarship Selection Committee. Thankfully, they let a few of us old former Rhodes Scholars ask the questions now. I'd hate to be answering them. It's a lot more fun to ask the questions. But about halfway through the first finalists that we had, and these were all incredibly bright people, as you mentioned, and they were just answering every tough question, every hypothetical situation we could throw at them. I don't know what caused me to ask, but I asked this first young man, I said, how long do you think the United States is going to be the world's leading superpower or one of the leading powers? And he'd been answering all these questions. All of a sudden, he looked at me like a deer in the headlights and just was silent. And he was silent, so sort of shuffled his feet. He was silent so long that the other members of the committee began to get sort of, you know, on edge. And so finally I said, well, you know, we're only 6% of the population of the world. India and China have economies that are growing so fast that in 25 years they'll be roughly the size of our own, at least in gross size. They could decide to spend their resources for military might if they wanted to. I said, what makes you think that we're going to continue to lead the world? Still silence. And so I went on, you know, I said, well, we don't have the Roman Empire anymore, the British Empire anymore, the Ottoman Empire anymore. And I finally said, what are the things you think will determine how long we're going to be one of the leading nations in the world? And then finally he said, well, maybe education. I said, well, that's a good place to start. If we're a small part of the population of the world, we certainly have to be the best educated people in the world. But what all of this said to me was, and by the way, a young woman came in next. I waited till she had answered many other questions and had her confidence up. I asked her the same question, same reaction.
Oh, my.
Utter shock and silence. Mm. And it went on all day with the other candidates. And I said to myself, you know, if these bright young people with their futures ahead of them are not thinking about the questions that really matter, the things that will really determine our future, what about the rest of us?
Right.
And so that's why I wrote the letter. It's been about, well, I'm sitting at the desk right now out of New Mexico where I wrote the letter. And you know, I wanted to stimulate all of us to start thinking about the things that really matter to the future of this country.
Right, which you have done. You talk about the fact that it was perhaps the irrelevance of most of the public discussion in a crucial presidential year that finally caused you to put pen to paper. And I am constantly amazed by the irrelevance of the discussion, partially, and maybe it's because I come from the vantage point of doing a talk show, and I love all of this, but I can't believe that we're all not vitally interested in what's going on. Instead, we're trying to get, you know, Brett Favre to go play for the Packers again.
Oh, I know.
Give me a break.
It just really... It's so frustrating, and the way we trivialize many of the things that we do talk about are the questions even that were asked during the presidential debates, whether people always wear flag pins and
their lapels
and things like that. And instead of talking about what in the world are we going to do about entitlements, for example, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, the interest on the debt, if we don't do something about it, it's going to consume every dollar we pay in taxes, just those things, in 25 years. Nothing left for defense, nothing left for education or transportation. We'll be leaving our children, our grandchildren, to decide to either do away with the safety net or double their taxes. And you know, you just think about these things that are really important that we want to hear from our candidates. The way the rest of the world feels about us, it's so crucial now because we can't, with 6% of the people, and we're learning this in Iraq, over $1 trillion gone, the economy now in the tank, people unemployed, gasoline at $4 a gallon. We can't bear all the burdens by ourselves, and we have had an incredible drop in the way the rest of the world views us. And England, for example, down from 92% to 22%, and by the way, they're number one in their regard for the United States. So why aren't we talking about these things and figuring out what to do about these things instead of all these trivial
things? And you ask that question again and again. You cite Turkey and what they think of us, and Germany and what they think of us, and what they used to think of us. And the big question is why? What has happened, Senator Boren, that gives us such a low opinion in the part of these countries?
Well, I think part of it is that, and by the way, the Zogby organization and the Pew organization that did a lot of this polling went back, and they were curious, thank goodness. They asked this question that you've just asked, and they found the answers came back that over 70% of the people in the rest of the world don't really think that we care what they think. Hmm. In other words, we don't listen. We project arrogance. They don't think we really care about what's going on in their countries and their needs. And, you know, you don't want to form a partnership with someone unless you think they that you're going to listen to them, that you really care about them. To me, one of the most dramatic contrasts, and I hope that the two candidates for president are really looking at this, one of the greatest contrasts is between what happened in the first Gulf War under President Bush Sr. and what has happened in this war in Iraq. The first Gulf War, and it's almost incredible when you think about it, cost the American taxpayers absolutely nothing. Zero. The president, Secretary of State Baker and others went out and took their time, and they formed this huge coalition that was real. By the way, the first troops that were very careful that saw active duty in that war were from Islamic countries, so we didn't create a situation where we looked like it was a war between two religions, and the countries that couldn't send troops, like Japan under their constitution, reimbursed us financially. In fact, we got reimbursed, over-reimbursed, about $60 million. We were honest enough to turn it back. And you compare that with this war, over $1 trillion and still counting when the troops come home and need medical care and educational help and other things. And it shows you the difference that occurs when we try to take all the burden on ourselves, when we don't have real partnerships, because this was really just a cosmetic coalition in this war. So I hope the new presidential candidates are learning from that, that if we're going to be a leader in the world, we have to lead with partnerships, and we have to lead with partners who are willing to help us share burdens. And that means meeting a lot of other people halfway and listening to them.
Right. And I believe you were one of those people. Tell me the story. I believe the conversation was with George Herbert Walker Bush when you were of the belief that we need to go in to finish this job here and get rid of Saddam Hussein. And you listened to all sides of the argument and essentially were persuaded that may not be the best thing to do.
Well, I was. You know, back I was persuaded. I was chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time, and I marched down to the White House. In fact, I'd even alerted the press who gather out front of the Oval Office out in the driveway that I might come out and have some comments. And I went in to see the president, and I said, "Mr. President, we've just swept the Iraqis out of Kuwait. Why don't we go ahead, march on Baghdad, get rid of Saddam Hussein, bring him down, bring him to trial, and finish the job?" And I think a lot of American people thought that at the time. They thought it's not the time to, as some commentators were criticizing senior President Bush, let's don't wimp out, let's finish the job. And so I went and said that to him. And usually he's such a gentleman, and usually he was very, very calm, but he got very agitated with me. And he said, first of all, he said, "Senator, what is your exit strategy? What's your exit strategy? You get us into the middle of Iraq, how are you going to get us out?" And I sort of bumbled that answer. I hadn't thought clearly enough about it. And then he said, "I'm going to call in General Scowcroft," and his national security advisor. And he said, "Now, Brent, David here thinks we ought to march on in Iraq. Let's tell him." He said, why don't you tell him about the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Kurds?" Hmm. Back then, we didn't really understand all those tribal rivalries. We come, unfortunately, to understand them all too well. He said, "You're going to start the darndest civil war that you ever saw." I explained it, gave me a history lesson. He said, "Iraq is going to implode. You're going to upset the balance of power in the Middle East. We're not going to be able to get out. We're going to endanger Israel and our moderate Arab friends." And he said, "The only country," I'll never forget this, "the only country that is going to be benefited in terms of its power is Iran." And when we finished that conversation, I looked at the president and I said, "Mr. President, you've convinced me. You're right. I'm wrong." I didn't go out to the television cameras and pound on the president. I slipped out through the back door. And you know, I've thought about that so often, and I thought, oh, if only we could have learned that lesson, right? And if only the second President Bush had sought the advice of some of those wise people around his father, we might be in a very different situation today.
Yeah, we're in a mess, aren't we? Just a mess.
We really are. And, you know, getting out of it is not going to be easy. And the other thing that we're in a mess about is partisanship at home. You know, you think about how we won World War II and how we won the Cold War. Well, we would have never won the Cold War, for example, if we had not gone in with the Marshall Plan, which was so controversial. Imagine President Truman, the Democrats, wanting to raise taxes to give money to people like the Germans that had just been killing our fathers and our sons and daughters. And yet, you had the Republicans under a man named Vandenberg from Michigan and others who said, "We have to do this as Americans because otherwise the Russians are going to take over all of Europe. Europe's on its back. The people are hungry. They'll fall for communism, and we'll be encircled." And, you know, then we stuck with containment, whether it was Democrats or Republicans in the White House. We really worked together in a bipartisan way, and now that's gone. When I first came to the Senate, it seems like ancient days ago in 1979, there were 8 new Democrats and 8 new Republican senators, and we had monthly potlucks, dinners at each other's houses with our spouses. We became personal friends. We were able to work together. Now the new members don't even get to know the members of the other party. They meet every week in party caucuses, and all they talk about is how to hurt the other party. There's no offsetting bipartisan caucus. So how are we going to solve these problems abroad, or getting together at home for do something about our infrastructure, do something about health care, do something about this entitlement reform to get our budget under control, if we are polarized so?
Right. Did you see, I hadn't seen the initial version, they ran on 60 Minutes last night, this repeat of a story from March, I believe it was, this doctor who used to work in third world countries and now is working in West Virginia and various places in the South where the healthcare need is just phenomenal. People have very debilitating illnesses. They need glasses. They can't hear. They might need surgery.
Right.
And they are lining up very, very early in the morning, having driven from hundreds of miles, parking in the parking lot, sleeping in the car to try to get medical attention. Hundreds and hundreds of people, and they have to be turned away because you can't take care of everybody. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, my gosh, this isn't a third world country. This is America.
No, it's shocking, and of course, one of my duties as president of the University of Oklahoma is to also oversee our Health Sciences Center, and I'm really happy to say that our students are giving back as volunteers in a remarkable way. So they are running very often these free medical clinics, free dental clinics, and so on, and we see the same thing. We see we see such an amazing turnout of people who need help, and we advertise when we're doing this, and we do it all through the year. And, you know, you think about it, I knew a man, in fact, he is the father-in-law of one of our officers at the university. He was a carpenter all his life. He never was on welfare. He paid taxes. He sent four children to college and one to technical school. And at the end of the week, he just didn't have anything left to buy health insurance.
Yeah.
He had a terrible bypass operation that left him deeply in debt. He was so worried about being a burden to his children, and about 2 months later, he had a ruptured appendix. He didn't even tell anyone at home. He was afraid to go back to the hospital because of the financial situation. He was afraid he'd lose his home, and, you know, he finally was taken to the hospital unconscious. He finally survived after several months.
Goodness.
But I asked myself, is that man's life worth more than mine? How can I make that kind of judgment? How could a person who's worked so hard all his life and have been what we might call the model American, getting his children educated and doing his part for the community, it's just not right. And so we have to find a way that we get together in a bipartisan direction and have universal health care for our people.
Yeah. You see stories like that, and I don't know how you can think something differently, because anybody could be in that position, anybody.
Anybody could, and we just have to do something about that. And, you know, you talk about slipping into third world status. Look at us now in the middle of the energy crisis. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had speed trains across the United States, you know, spoking out from places like Milwaukee and Chicago and the whole area and the upper Midwest? Or we tried to do it in Oklahoma with Texas at one time, and it failed. But we have an infrastructure that is absolutely crumbling. And the reason we don't have speed trains, where someone told me the other day, I was shocked, we're still running on the same kind of trackage that we built in this country in the 1880s.
Oh, my.
Think back to that golden spike when we had the first transcontinental railroad. We haven't progressed all that much since then. And so the chickens are coming home to roost, and we're going to have to join together. And this is something I hope politicians will say. We have to make some sacrifices, and we've always been willing to sacrifice for the next generation to make it better for them. And I think politicians need to quit telling us what they think we want to hear and start telling us what we need to hear. And I tried to do that when I was in office. I think all people in office who run for re-election are tempted to sort of not be quite as blunt. So I've been waiting a long time to be as blunt as I have been. I should have been more blunt a long time ago, but that's why the book is as blunt as it is.
Our guest is David Boren. He's a former U.S. Senator, a Rhodes Scholar. He was the longest-serving chair of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. He's a former governor of Oklahoma. He has served as president of the University of Oklahoma for the past 13 years. And the book is A Letter to America. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050, or send an email if you'd like to do that, and that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Senator David Boren. The book is A Letter to America, and it is published by Oklahoma Press. And start with Ed from Wautoma. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have 3 points I'd like to make, if I may. You know, the United States, we're trying to compete with cheap labor and manufacturing, whereas this country has the deepest topsoil, the deepest water aquifer, and the mildest climate. You know, I've been studying agriculture around the world, whereas, for example, Japanese increase their agriculture 17 times over the same kind of climate and conditions in India. And I was thinking if we raise the price of a bushel of wheat to $40 in our export, you know, the there's, the, for example, the Chinese have one-third the world's population and 25% of the arable land as the United States. So basically, if the price of a bushel of wheat was $40, you know, they we wouldn't want to see a lot of Chinese people starve, but we could give it to them on credit, and they would owe us maybe $200 million worth of services and manufactured goods. And the same with the oil-producing Persian Gulf. They don't have arable land like we do. And if that was the case, farms here in the United States could intensify their farming so that we wouldn't want to see 20 million Arabians starve to death, but, you know, we give them the oil on credit. And if Americans got used to paying $10 for a loaf of bread, but oil was a buck and a quarter a gallon, that would kind of even out the things, you know. So we would take advantage of the macro economics of what we have here at our disposal, a blessed country that could be the world's food producer. The other point I'd like to make is that these wars that in Iraq, Iran, and so forth, you know, we could send the troops home and insulate houses a 3 foot thick. And the same kind of emphasis we're putting on war, we could save energy that easily and compensate the businesses that are now in that through the first couple of years of tax dollars through energy savings.
Okay. David Boren?
Well, I think that our caller, Ed, has some good points here to make. We need to emphasize things that we can do here at home. I don't know that we'd ever want to get wheat as high as $40 a bushel because we would have such instability and rioting and problems all over the world that we'd probably upset the balance of our ability to sell. But already what's happening, as we've seen, is food prices have been really, really going up, in part because we have been using things like corn to produce ethanol and other kinds of fuel products. But I think he's as long as we're careful to try to maintain some kind of balance, he's right. We can take our benefits in agriculture and do a lot more with those benefits, and we can sell to those countries that need our agricultural products. We can also use a lot more of those products to produce energy that can fuel our automobiles and can generate electricity and doing other things. Switchgrass is one that's just come up,
mm-hmm.
and I've been watching that, being from the prairies. It can be used with a little more research, but we're going to have a Manhattan-like project to learn how to develop clean coal technology, where we have a lot of coal, to learn how to take agricultural products like switchgrass and turn them into energy. We also need to be doing things that will keep the jobs at home, like rebuilding the infrastructure of our country. We talk about gasoline. I read a figure, it's a year old, so it must be at least two or three times that much. Just the fact that our highway system is so inadequate is costing Americans more than $1 billion, and I'm sure it's now $2 or $3 billion, in lost wages and income each year because it's taking so much longer for them to commute. And I've mentioned a lot of other things. We need to be, and we could be agriculturally more productive. If we would use our heads and develop, for example, a water grid, we have an electric grid, let's use a water pipeline system that could move water from areas that are experiencing floods and too much water into arid areas that need them in reservoirs. All sorts of things that we can do. Wind power is another thing we're working on. Things that create jobs here at home. And I think Ed is so right when you think about what we're spending on this war. And it is a civil war, as the first President Bush pointed out to me. I've always wondered, how does one country win a civil war in another country? I don't think France or Germany or England won the civil war in the United States. So many things could be done if those young people could be brought home and put to work on projects that would reduce our energy consumption, make us more energy efficient, and rebuild our infrastructure here at home. So I think he's just pointing out there are a lot of things we can do right here at home and develop the advantages we have. We're in a global economy, and we have to develop our advantages.
Thanks, Ed, very much for the call. Talk, please, Senator Boren, a little bit about your work with students. I know that for the past 26 semesters, you've taught university freshmen in a course in American government and politics. They have rekindled, you say, your hope and your idealism. They've become friends and colleagues, and you partially write this book because of them.
I really did. I they do inspire me, and I do dedicate the book to them. I think we are past what might be called the yuppie period in our history, and I find these young people that I'm teaching now very committed to giving back to the society. We have an incredibly active volunteerism program at the University of Oklahoma. Many others do as well. Students give back hundreds of thousands of hours in activities. They're tutoring students that need it. We've increased tenfold our number of Big Brothers, Big Sisters, helping young people at risk. It's really, to me, very inspirational to see what they want to do, and also their attitudes toward the families they want to create. They want to make sure, they want to avoid the split-ups, the problems that so many of them, more than half of them, have come from homes that have been torn apart, and they really want to bring about stability. The one thing that it's exciting for me to participate in, and I mentioned this in the book, is I teach American government, and there's a little blurb on the back of my book by David McCullough, the great historian, who says, if we forget how we became great, we won't remain great. And it's really shocking as I try to reach these students, and I'm happy to say we require American government and American history at OU in order to get a degree.
Great.
But only 8% of the colleges and universities in the country require a single course in our own
really?
Government. Yes, only 8%
oh my.
Are in our own history to get a college degree, and it's bringing about terrible results. And high school seniors last year, 50% of them thought we fought on the side of Nazis.
I know. I couldn't believe it. I
said, "Can you believe that?"
No, I couldn't.
And then the Ivy League schools, and I attended Yale University and very proud of that, but I wasn't proud of their score on how much their own students. They don't require. Almost none of the Ivy League schools specifically require a course in American government and American history to graduate. And in one poll, for example, 30% of them couldn't name George Washington as our commander in the Revolutionary War.
Oh,
these are Ivy League schools, only Ivy League schools. And 25% of them thought the president could suspend the Bill of Rights at his own discretion or her own discretion anytime the president wanted to. And, you know, you sit there and you think, how in the world are we're all citizens. We have an obligation to understand our system, and that worries me. So I have that worry about our younger generation, but I find them hungry as students. They really, it pleases me. I'm still getting letters saying, I've gotten involved in politics, or I've run for the state legislature, the city council, because I took these courses, and it really and they want to give back. That means so much to me. So I'm an optimist about the future of this country because I think this younger generation has the right attitude.
Yeah. Do you still have a son in Congress?
I do. I do have a son in Congress. He's in the House. And my father was in Congress as well. So I think we're the first family west of the Mississippi that's had three in a row without interruption serving in Congress. So I guess my father infected me with it first. He used to take me around and make me make speeches on the radio when I was five. So I don't think I had a chance to avoid it. And my son used to go with me to political meetings when he was very young, and usually he sat in the car with his arms crossed and didn't want to have anything to do with it. And then all of a sudden the bug bit him as well.
So, which points to the fact that a lot of this develops in our homes too, right? So that we need to be engaged parents.
We have to be engaged parents. And I might say my other offspring, my daughter, is in full-time religious work. She is an ordained minister, and she works in full-time religious work. And I have to think that a lot of this started, it was kind of a family tradition. We had politicians and ministers and teachers principally in our family. My father was one of eight children. And we always sat around the dinner table and maybe argued sometimes it got into arguments about politics, about religion, about what was going on in the world around us. We always had books around us, and that's one of the things my wife has made certain about our children is that there were always books, and a lot of times we read books together out loud. And I think those kinds of things really stimulate our children to get involved, and they're very much needed. We need that personal conversation, too. The Internet's right. been of great advantage. But we also need to sit down, see each other, interact with each other as human beings. And watching students sometimes text message each other when they're within 100 yards of each other.
I know.
It sort of drives me crazy.
Me too. Let's go to Jim from Salt Lake City. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. Great guest. Hey, I'd like to ask a serious question of your guest, with all respect. If he had a chance to meet with the senior Bush and knew about all the consequences of invading Iraq,
yes.
Did he let anyone else know about this,
yes.
Especially before the start of the war? Because, you know, being a former senator, I think your voice would have carried pretty loud and clear, saying, you know, have we thought this all the way through? I mean, this seems to be, you're the first elected official who knew about this. Grant, you were out of office, but, man, I'm just so surprised that we knew this, but the public didn't.
Yes, obviously personal conversations with presidents, I think you should only recite carefully. But let me say this: the current President Bush, I don't think had any doubts as to how I felt about it. If you read Bob Woodward's book, which talks about the beginnings of the war and what happened right after 9/11. And I was having breakfast the morning at the actual moment the plane went into the buildings with George Tenet, who at that time was the director of the CIA. And then if you read his book, Tenet's book as well, you will see that I urged him to resign several times if the president would not listen to him about the consequences of going into Iraq the way we did. So, yes, I did try to make it known what I thought the consequences would be. I cannot really speculate on what might have been said between President Bush Sr. and President Bush, the current President Bush. But I've had many conversations with people like Jim Baker and Colin Powell and George Tenet and others that were involved during this period of time. And let me put it this way. I would be shocked if the current president did not receive several warnings from several sources that would have had more credibility than myself, but some of them originating with me. So I have not stopped giving advice. And one of the interesting things, by the way, I sent my book to the presidential candidates back in the primary period, and I don't know if you noticed in one of the debates, Senator Obama was asked, is there any living former president that you would seek foreign policy advice from? And I think people expected him, especially in the Democratic primary, this was in the Democratic primary, to say maybe President Clinton or a Democrat. He said President Bush Sr., and the questioner was shocked. And he said, why? And he said, well, look at how he handled that first war and the cost, casualties, burden to the taxpayers, the rest of it, versus the situation we're in now. And so that, I think, came from his remembering a certain portion in the book that we've talked about earlier. So, yes, I still do, and it's try to speak out. And, of course, now one of the things I feel I can most do is try to educate students and the next generation. And so I do teach, and it's the only thing that makes being a university president worthwhile. The budgets are no fun and all the rest of it. It's teaching every semester, and so I teach a small honors seminar and then a very large lecture course of 300 or 400 every year with freshmen, mainly get them off the right track.
Yeah, but that's wonderful.
You're right. No, I felt I still had an obligation to speak out. I don't think that only senators should be speaking out. I think all of us should. And if we have experiences that cause us to see what we're about to get into, I'll put it this way. With some of those individuals I've mentioned, I remember one of them got up. We were having dinner together, and I was pleading with him to do everything he could to get the president not to go into Iraq in this way. And he finally said, it's just no fun having dinner with you anymore. You're so intense. So, yes, I have. It's the long answer to a short question.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050, if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Former Senator David Bourne is our guest. His book is A Letter to America. He was the longest-serving chair of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee, a former U.S. senator, governor of Oklahoma, has served as president of the University of Oklahoma for the past 13 years. Our lines are filled right now. You can send an email if you'd like, and that's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to an email for Senator Bourne. This comes from Frank from Howard. The decline is inevitable. It's just a matter of history. There's no reason to think the U.S. will decline slowly to a soft landing in the manner of the British and French empires. The history of Portugal is instructive. It declined in a generation or two to desperate poverty, which lasted 300 years, precipitated by the Lisbon earthquake, from which the country was unable to recover. Given the experience, Senator Bourne, of New Orleans, is there any reason to think that the U.S. could recover from the big one hitting California?
Well, goodness, I don't know that I'm expert enough to answer that. Yes, I think we can. And the reason that I answer with that optimism is that again, as you read American history, we have always been the kinds of people who can do. We're always the people with a positive spirit. That's one of the things that worries me right now, the fact that two-thirds of our people think that our future will not be as great as our past. So we have to be able to, and I think part of that is every person has to feel a sense of responsibility to be involved, and it's one of the problems, I think, with this war. The main people fighting this war are people that are doing so because they didn't have jobs, they needed income, and certainly some, I'm not demeaning the patriotism, that's certainly there. But the problem is that most of us cannot be said to be making a sacrifice. Most of the members of Congress have no children or grandchildren fighting there. I remember it was a terrible moment in a class that I had. A student was arguing vociferously for the war. And I said to him, well, if you're so strongly for it, I assume you're going to enlist and go over. And he said, oh, no, we have people we pay to do that.
Mm.
It was, and another student raised his hand in my class and said, President Bourne, can you ever think of a time during any war we ever had in which we cut taxes? And we cut taxes and gave ourselves a tax cut instead of making some sacrifice to help the people that were fighting the war. You know, this is an attitude that creeps in, and I think that it's something that we have to really turn around in this country when you think about going through the Great Depression and this country staying intact and other countries not being strong enough to do so. We saw what happened in Germany and Hitler's rise to power, for example. So if you look at American history, I think there's a strong answer that we have a good chance to meet any challenge. I think we're going to have to do it in a new way, and I just got through reading Fareed Zakaria's little book, Post-American World, and he's a very interesting person. I actually first got to know him while he was still a college student, and he used to come to Washington to visit me as a senator. And he says, you know, there's no reason why the United States still can't be the premier leader, if you want to call it that, maybe not the world's only superpower in that kind of chest-beating sense. But he said, you look at the other countries that are leaders, and it's the first time we've been in a world where there are many centers of power, particularly economic. The Chinese, they have terrible problems at home. There are two or three Chinas, and we've seen that with the earthquake in the interior. There's still many people who live in poverty and very primitive conditions, even though that's a country really on the move. The political deadlocks that occur in India make it difficult for it to become a major player on the world stage. The Russians are really struggling to create a democratic legal system, even though their oil reserves have bounced them back as a world power. And the Europeans are really struggling because of the low birth rate and the productivity there. We could go on down the list. And so when you really get down to it, if we learn how to be partners, if we learn how to lead in a new way, there's a great need for the United States. In fact, there would be a huge void in the world if the United States did not serve as the catalyst. Not the only leader, not my way or the highway, willing to meet other people halfway, listening and so on. This century, the 21st century, can also be the century of American leadership, but it will be a different kind of leadership, and one that will spring from our values, spring from the stability of our own country, our own history. So, and Zakaria ends up that way. In fact, I think I would change the title of his book, not the Post-American World. I would call it a new kind of American leadership, because that's what he's really talking about.
Let's go to Joy from West Bend. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Your guest is moving in the direction that I was wanting to talk about. I just think it's interesting how the question that you started with was, you know, kind of helps form the answer. I would change the question to something more like, when do you think we'll be ready for world government, or how do you think we can form a world government that would have a chance of being a democracy? I think that we would have a better chance of spreading democracy throughout the world if it was a world democracy. I think that another question could be, how can we make sure that food, work, shelter, education, healthcare are evenly distributed in a fair way so that everyone in the world can help care for the earth in a sustainable way, and then we won't have to worry about strategizing about being the top power. We won't have to spend so much on military defense. We won't have to occupy other countries. I just think that we could go in a different direction. For instance, the benchmarks we're waiting for the legislature in Iraq to pass have to do with our corporations having the majority of the profits and the control of where the oil goes, and having our government and our mercenaries having no chance of being prosecuted for things that they might do wrong. And those things, if we could give up having to have control, if we could share more, if we could just let things be more evenly distributed, then we would be part of the power, like you said, and we wouldn't have to be the top power.
Well, I think that I think where you're going is in many ways the way I'm going. I don't know that it has to be a world government. I think we can retain our own sovereignty, but one of the things we have to give up is arrogance and a certain insistence on dominance. You know, when I talked about forming partnerships, no one wants to form a partnership with someone that's not even going to listen to them. No one's going to want to form a partnership with a nation that wants all its own way without any concern for the other country and the rights of those people and their hopes and their aspirations. George Washington wrote something, and I happened to read it. It was a little, I picked it up and I read it on an airplane, 60 pages, and it, I've always admired him so much, but I don't know that I really understood what a highly intelligent man he was. He said, don't ever enter into an agreement that is too one-sided. Hmm. The United States should never seek an agreement that we clearly win. He said the only kind of agreement that lasts is one where both sides win, because if one side feels aggrieved by this agreement, they'll set it aside as soon as they can. Look at World War I. That we learned that lesson there. So I think we have to do that. We have to think about, you know, every country in the world has a different history, and this is another reason why we need to not be arrogant about that either. You know, we need to learn their languages. We need to learn about their cultures, their histories. And sometimes their cultures, it's like planting a palm tree in Canada. You can't do it. It's not going to live. You can move those countries and by our example, not our military power, but the power of our example, move those countries in the right directions on their values. But in some ways, we have to be patient about transplanting our own political system into a culture that's very different. One of the things that I've urged the presidential candidates to do is to create an international Peace Corps. You think about young people, 18 to, say, 24, it's a time when they really do form bonds of friendship that last the rest of their lives. If you could put together teams, and every country would take turn chairing the board of this International Peace Corps, and they go out and they create water systems for villages that need it, or they create parks for inner cities, or they do all sorts of things together. Think of a team of 15 young people, each from a different country. Many of them, they'll get to know each other. They'll become friends. Many of them will become leaders in their countries. These are the kinds, I think, of ways we need to start thinking. We've thought too long that the only way we defended our national interest was militarily. We've even forgotten how to use diplomacy. And we need to think creatively about building these bonds of friendship for the next generation. I think there are a lot of ways we can do that, and the International Peace Corps is just one of the ideas.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
I hope our listener would agree with that.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Time for maybe one more phone call. Bonnie from Madison, hi.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. Well, this was just to follow up on the excellent point your guest was just making. I would encourage him, I'm sure he's doing it already, to encourage his students to get to know all the international students at his university, and encourage other university officials to do the same, because I learned so much, I think more than from my courses, from the international students.
Right.
And to have them tell me how U.S. policy, foreign policy, affected them in their everyday lives. I think so many Americans are not aware of that. And just for one small example, quickly, and I'll end it, is people would ask me, why are we supporting these dictatorships? For example, the apartheid government in South Africa years ago, or the awful dictatorships in Latin America, where they have many mass graves of dissenters. I think people can do that right at home. Just try to get to know all the international students, as many as they can, and it would be a real wake-up call.
Well, this almost, Kathleen, sounds like a planted question, because it really speaks to my heart. At OU, we've started a program we call Cousins. We have over 1,000 students from 100 different countries, and this year we had 3,000 American students volunteer to be cousins to our international students, to do things together, to invite them to their homes. And we also, have to brag a little bit here, we ranked number one in the entire country of public or private schools in exchanges with over 160 universities around
Wonderful.
The world. And so I think it's so true. You not only learn about those countries, it's the way you look at your own country through the eyes of people from other places. And it teaches us so much. And so I couldn't agree more. I appreciate the question so much. And this is something that all of our universities, we're repositories of more than
right.
500,000 international students. We ought to take every advantage for American students to get to know them.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you, Senator Boren, so much for being with us and for the book.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Senator David Boren, it's A Letter to America, just been published by Oklahoma Press. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing, John Anderson for on-air production.